Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We'll be talking about the interaction between police and African-American communities. There's been no shortage of disturbing and sometimes violent examples of that relationship in recent months and years. Our first guest has taken a close look and is taking a close look as well. Dr. Andrea Boyles is Division Chair of Social and Behavioral Sciences and an Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at Lindenwood University in Belleville. She has received grant funding for her study titled How Do Blacks Police Themselves? Its focus is on how blacks feel about neighborhood crime and what they can do about it. She is also the author of a 2015 book titled Race, Place, and Suburban Policing, Too Close for Comfort. Dr. Boyles joins us in studio. Nice to have you with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Don.
You're just getting started, I know, in this most recent study. Are you hearing anything yet? Is it too early to draw any kind of conclusions from what you're doing?
Thus far, I would say it's too early in the sense of providing intimate details into how black folks, particularly in what has been dubbed as hotspot communities here in St. Louis, how they feel about crime in their neighborhood and more importantly, what kinds of efforts and things are occurring at the ground level, meaning individually and collectively in some of these communities. However, I have had experience and have had some findings from my prior project that spoke to African-American perceptions of crime and those kinds of things as they unfolded in their communities, but that would have been primarily in the suburban areas.
Sure. So what have you been hearing in general up to this point?
So if I draw from my book, Race, Place, Suburban, and Policing, which was a project conducted in Meacham Park, one of the things that I highlight in the book is I sort of address the notion that blacks are somehow embracing of lawlessness. I think the idea extends from this notion that black people may not work well with policing, like oftentimes they are not accommodating with policing efforts in their community. And we know from studies that is, you know, much of that hinge on lack of trust between black folks and law enforcement. And so a lot of times what I think people do, they draw conclusions from the fact that black people may not engage with law enforcement in terms of dealing with crime prevention or crime efforts in their communities, that then translates to them embracing lawlessness or harboring criminals, and that's just not true.
This is a misperception.
It's
what we want to make absolutely
clear.
Yes,
it's a misconception.
Well, that Meacham Park, of course, is in Kirkwood, and it's suburban. What about the differences between urban and suburban perceptions?
So what I argue through Race, Place, and Suburban Policing is that, so let me begin here, much of what we know in terms of black citizen police conflict often extends from urban studies, urban projects. And so what I did in my project is used urban studies and extended it, particularly Jody Miller and Rod Brunson's projects conducted here in the city of St. Louis. I took those projects and extended them into suburban communities. And what I argue based on theories like race and place effect is that as blacks migrate into seemingly predominantly white communities, that the threat level increases for those populations. And as a result, it shapes and has a tendency to propel even more aggressive policing. So we know through race and place effect that, and that project in particularly suggests that when blacks were crossing out of predominantly black spaces into predominantly white spaces, that they were surveilled more. So there is a precedence for having that kind of thing occur. And so I tapped into Meacham Park, and given the history of racial contention there, thought that it might be an ideal place to sort of gauge that existing theory, Meehan and Ponders,
When you speak of threats, you're talking about the black population feeling threatened from the police?
Well, white populations in general. What I do is I situate black citizen police conflict in historical perspectives. And history suggests that, you know, the racial threat tends to increase when black populations become or live within closer proximity to white populations. I extend that sort of from the notion of, and I chronicle in my book things like slavery, particularly slave patrol, and how they were enacted and what they looked like in terms of relegating and policing slave populations. And so much of that was about making sure that there were no insurrections or eliminating the possibility of threat for insurrections. And so I sort of use that as an analogy and parallel it to present day circumstance. So it's one thing. And then I also include the history of suburbanization. And so suburbanization was about moving away white populations, moving away from, quote unquote, the undesirables. The undesirables being poor blacks, poor Jews, you know, that kind of thing, but staying within sure. close proximity of the inner city. And so between those various things from a historical perspective, sundown towns and all those kinds of things that I also include in my book, I use those sort of as a platform or a launching pad to further the discussion of what happens when black folks are no longer existing in what has been perceived as quote unquote black communities, and they start to migrate well beyond city limits into now what becomes seemingly predominantly white areas.
I just want to explain for those who may not be terribly familiar with the term sundown towns. Those are communities in which African Americans were not welcomed when the sun went down.
Absolutely. And most people think that they were only existing in the South. The reality of it is they were very prevalent and common in the Midwest, particularly here in Missouri, from one end of the state to the other.
And in fact, there are some communities today
yes.
that are, in fact, sundown towns, although obviously they're not supposed to be.
Yes. And so what they would say is that they're predominantly white on purpose.
Yeah. Where do you expect this to take you? I mean, your research is starting. You've done a great deal of it with regard to your Meacham Park study and your suburban studies. Where do you expect the other part of it, the new study, to take you?
So the new study is, again, entitled or sort of hinge on the question of how do blacks police themselves? And that study emerged as I was already, one, engaged in research on black citizen police conflict there in Meacham Park and Kirkwood, and had spent significant amount of time collecting data in Ferguson and other locations where direct actions had been taking place surrounding the Mike Brown shooting and other like circumstances and debates that continue. Honestly, to emerge that questioned or challenged and suggested that blacks disdain suggested black disdain and action surrounding police proprieties seemed to be more important than high rates of crime in their own communities. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, you know, this is sort of emerged out of this idea that, you know, okay, so black populations are up in arms when it comes to death by virtue of police engagement, but then when there are deaths in their neighborhoods or their communities, the response doesn't seem to be the same. And so my project, again, How Do Blacks Police Themselves, emerged as an effort. And let me be clear, policing in that sense, in my project, I'm referring to serving and protecting. And so one of the things I wanted to extend was a platform to black folks in some of these, particularly in these communities, to give them, I wanted to allow them space to speak for themselves rather than have these persisting assumptions, these misconceptions existing that would say they are okay with crime.
Yeah.
And, you know, like there are differences in they're lackadaisical when it comes to other kinds of crimes and things, but only concerned with law enforcement.
I'm not entirely sure I fully understand what you mean when you're talking about blacks policing themselves. Give that to me in a sentence or two, if you would, so that I perhaps can better understand it.
So when I talk about blacks policing themselves, again, what I'm looking at are I'm extending a platform for Black citizens to talk about efforts that they take within their neighborhoods, in an effort to serve and protect themselves, even in the face of crime.
It has been fairly well established. I know in the city of St. Louis, where there are neighborhood organizations and where neighbors and friends are working together and being alert and watching what's going on in the neighborhood, that crime drops dramatically.
Sure.
Is that your finding?
I can't speak per se to the fluctuation of crimes, high or low. What I can say, particularly regarding Black communities, is that the rates of crime tend to be higher in those locations versus others, because these are generally populations that lack and suffer from inept social services. And so when you leave people with minimum or no means for surviving, people tend to resort to tactics of survival, and those tactics can extend themselves from one extreme to another. And so the lack of social services and so forth and all these issues tend to create an atmosphere where higher crime rates compared to other places becomes more susceptible.
That's a pretty good segue for our next segment, by the way. But we have other things to talk about.
Sure.
Let's take a break now. We're talking with Dr. Andrea Boyles, from Lindenwood University in Belleville. We're talking about studies she is in the process of making and has made with regard to Black communities and how Blacks in those communities can, should, would police themselves. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We're continuing our conversation with Dr. Andrea Boyles of Lindenwood University in Belleville. We're talking about the work she's doing dealing with neighborhood crime, particularly in African-American neighborhoods. Dr. Boyles, I had shown you something that we saw in the paper this morning concerning the carjacking shooting death of a young woman in downtown St. Louis just a couple of days ago. And there was a memorial gathering at the site of that shooting last night. And one of the lines that was quoted there, one of the people was quoted as saying, "This is an issue we have to fix ourselves." How do you fix that kind of a situation? I mean, what's the route to fixing a problem like that?
So fixing in general, so I like to think about things from a structural perspective. So if we were talking about fixing things in general, that would have to start with national, state, and local government, because those are the spaces where resources and so forth are delegated, sort of the trickle-down effect. We know that Black populations are disproportionately impoverished, and much of that hinges on institutional racism. So that would certainly be one of the most important places to begin fixing, is to fix or deal with and readily be prepared to hop in both feet deep and address racism at every level and in every space in policy and practice. When we talk about fixing things, nobody can fix us but us. That was sort of spill in and lend itself to my project, the current project, because that's one of the things that I want to tackle. I have thought about this idea of empowerment, and what that sort of says is that because there is such distrust with law enforcement, Black folks are saying that, yes, we recognize that there are crime issues in our communities, and yes, we are readily engaged and prepared to jump in both feet deep and deal with it, and maybe dealing with it amongst ourselves becomes a more important option, particularly as people are extremely distrustful of law enforcement and distrustful of actions that have been taken and that continue to be taken in shaping or reshaping or deconstructing and reconstructing policing policies and practices within these communities.
But, if we're talking about communities that are poor, the political clout in such communities is a lot less than it is in other places.
Sure.
How do you develop the clout to make the kind of changes you're suggesting politically and going to leadership, if you will?
So change, provoking change, and I'll say this from a sociological perspective, unfortunately, social change historically has never occurred except there was some catastrophic event that propelled it as such. Mm-hmm. And so it is often, and I would liken it to, for example, Mike Brown, you know, his death. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, Mike Brown's death would certainly be an example. People around the nation and around the world chimed in and took notice because of the civil unrest, because the death, and I would say that the death was more or less a catalyst. It was not the end-all, be-all to social issues and inadequacies, but it certainly became the straw that broke the camel's back in this region.
Yeah, and it spawned the Black Lives Matter movement, and I have to wonder if that has generated any significant change at this point. Almost 2 years later.
Well, that's just it. You know, people are, and one of the things that in much of the data collection that I was engaged in there in Ferguson, and often a lot of the meetings and, you know, community events that I attended, that was one of the things that people, they hammered on is like it cannot be business as usual. People were tired. And so, i.e., we have civil unrest happening. When you say, how do we change this? How do we fix mm-hmm. this? I think one way, again, is by, you know, at a broader level is dealing with racial injustice. And racial injustice cannot begin and end with Black people. It has to begin and end with white allies and other individuals in educating and encouraging and motivating and deconstructing and reconstructing some of these paradigms.
Well, the Missouri legislature, which is predominantly white, has not really tackled much in the way of the issues that came out of Ferguson. There's been some court reform that has taken place. The most recent session has dealt with use of force issues regarding the police. But a lot of things have been left on the table. It just doesn't seem to be happening.
And unfortunately, it's like an illness. If you do not address it at the root level, you continue to sort of band-aid the symptoms. It festers. And it becomes infectious, and it becomes infectious in such a way that it spreads. And so we have an opportunity, and you specifically say lawmakers and so forth, they have an opportunity to jump in both feet deep and deal with these issues. And sometimes that dealing with them means ownership, right? And so ownership can be painful. And oftentimes I think that's where people sort of get hung up at, you know, mm-hmm. this idea, I don't want to be blamed. I don't want to be the person. And so it ultimately ends up lending itself to not doing anything.
Yeah. If we have a couple of people who want to get into this conversation, let's bring them in. We'll start with Mike, who is calling from St. Louis. Mike, thanks for being with us. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Don. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'm a criminologist here in St. Louis, and I've been involved with a lot of the community policing efforts that are going on. I'm actually currently working with Ferguson. And I just wanted to read a quote that I ran across in some of my research from a National Advisory Commission report that I think really speaks to the issues that we're discussing on the air today. Criminal justice professionals readily and repeatedly admit that in the absence of citizen assistance, neither more manpower nor improved technology nor additional money will enable law enforcement to shoulder the monumental burden of combating crime. That was actually a report from 1977. So this is something that we've been dealing with in the research and law enforcement community for well over 40 years now. And I just wanted to say thanks for having this conversation.
Mike, thank you for calling. Well, I think Dr. Boyles, we've already established that it goes back a lot farther than 40 years. You've traced it back to Civil War days and sundown towns and all the rest of it.
From the onset of the nation.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I like to say that there is a precedence, again, for when we talk about a lot of times research, you know, sort of focuses in or words it as negotiating. How do Black populations negotiate police interactions or their responses or negotiate or sort of, you know, neighborhood crime and those kinds of things? And really that lends itself to protection. And that happens friends individually, whether you're the neighborhood mom that sort of watches and keep eye on all the children, you know, and make sure, you know, that they're, you know, acting in accordance, you know, or whether you are part of a neighborhood watch or whether you're part of the local church. So there is a history for some engagement, you know.
You know, a lot of people were caught by surprise by what happened in Ferguson, learning about the policing and the perception of bias and all the rest of it.
Well, I don't think it was a surprise.
Not to the people who live there.
To the people that live there. And I would say widely, not necessarily with black populations, because oftentimes they are disproportionately subject to police aggression in urban and suburban settings across the nation.
That's where I was going with this. Mm-hmm. I didn't catch anybody by surprise who's been victimized by this. But it also says something else to me, and that is that people who are so victimized are invisible to the rest of us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the purpose of me conducting qualitative in-depth interviews. Mm-hmm. And here's the other thing. You know, are they invisible by accident or invisible on purpose? Because I think that people have been screaming in more ways than one that help and assistance has been needed. We have an entire history that documents the aggressiveness and relegating and segregating and distancing and sort of quarantining socially black populations at every level. Law enforcement is just one aspect. In fact, it's just a visible arm of the local government. But that practice has been rampant through policy and otherwise. And so when we say invisible, their voices have been invisible only or lacking to the degree that it didn't make for comfortable dialogue. Mm-hmm. It didn't make comfortable for ownership or comfortable for changing it.
You talk about working with the communities and working with leadership to affect change. What about working with the police? I mean, if the police are the problem, that's where the change has to happen.
Sure. And I talk about some of those things in my book, Race, Place, and Suburban Policing. And so, again, the police do not, whether in urban settings or in suburban settings or perhaps rural even, they don't exist as an island, right? They are attached to their local governments. And police chiefs, they have folks and they have bosses that they have to answer to as well. And so for those changes to take place, it requires accountability and commitment at every level. You can't have one facet or one area in agreement with a particular kind of policing with black people. And what black people want to be a part of is policing, and they are willing to work with law enforcement, but law enforcement that does not see them as the other and that does not treat them as inherently criminal.
Do you think there is a difference between police, small town policing, suburban policing, and big city policing?
I think that when we consider race, I think, again, based on past research, the suggestion is that it looks the same in terms of aggressively policing black spaces. And it doesn't mean, you know, it did not necessarily matter if those black spaces were in urban settings or suburban settings or rural settings for that matter. It's the notion or this ideology that black people by virtue of birth are inherently criminal and as a result, need regulating in a particular way that is different from white populations. And so often in those spaces, you see proactive, aggressive policing taking place. And then they would argue, well, we police based on crime rates, right? Or based on place. But the reality of it is we still live in very segregated neighborhoods and segregated places. And you can't police place without also inevitably policing race.
You mentioned hotspot policing at the very outset of our conversation.
Sure.
Is that something that you're in favor of? Does that work? Is it a good strategy?
What I would argue is that in communities where there is already an extreme amount of distrust for law enforcement, I don't think the answer, the end-all, be-all answer or solution is to flooding those communities with even larger numbers of officers and...
even if they're high-crime neighborhoods?
Well, here's the thing. They may be high-crime communities, but what we know to be true based on research is that crime often occurs at the hand of a few in neighborhoods. But what happens is that when it comes to addressing it, it often incriminates the larger part of those neighborhoods and populations who are not engaged in criminal activity. So we don't want to criminalize neighborhoods that may have high rates of crime, but in terms of citizens are predominantly law-abiding. They should not be subject to that, to the treatment that may be warranted at the hands of a few individuals. And that is typically what happened. If we're going to target a community, target the individuals, the criminals in the community, and find ways to create relationships with the people in the neighborhood that they, where they feel comfortable engaging and not engaging and engaging at the risk of being criminalized or having their name dropped. And those are the kinds of things I talk about in my books. Folks, you know, instances where they could have engaged and names were dropped, you know, where they thought they were anonymous. And, you know, so there are some mishaps even when Black folks have tried to engage with assisting law enforcement efforts.
It's going to be very interesting to see how your study unfolds. And keep us posted on that, if you will, Dr. Andrea
sure.
Boyles. Of Lindenwood University. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And good luck with what you're up to. You've got a lot on your plate, obviously.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.